Hey everyone, it's Marvin. This episode of Books and Boba is brought to you by Chinese Republicans, a brand new biting and dramatic satirical drama from the Roundabout Theater Company in New York City. Set in New York in 2019, the play follows three high-powered businesswomen who meet for lunch every month to discuss their latest career triumphs, as they've done for decades. But the group is jolted when Katie, a bright-eyed 24-year-old new to the workforce, joins to navigate the world of corporate finance. As each woman attempts to steer Katie towards what they're certain is best, they're forced to grapple with how much they already have and are willing to sacrifice to climb the corporate ladder. Exploring themes of assimilation, intergenerational conflict, and gender politics in the workplace, all with unflinching wit and empathy, Chinese Republicans is a play for anyone who's ever tried to succeed inside a system that wasn't built for them. Written by Alex Lin, an exciting new Asian American playwright, and directed by Che Yu, the play stars Jennifer Keita, Julie Lee, Jimmy Award finalist Anna Zalveson, and Emmy Award winner Jodie Long. So if you find yourself in New York anytime soon, don't miss your chance to be a part of the world premiere of a new Asian American classic. Chinese Republicans will be playing at the Laura Pelz Theater in New York City from February 5th through April 5th. Tickets are on sale now. Learn more at roundabouttheater.org. That's theater with the R-E. And now, on to the show.
You're listening to Whoa! Potluck.
And hey, welcome to Books and Boba, a book club and podcast featuring books by Asian and Asian American authors. My name is Marvin Yue.
And I'm Rira Yu.
And we are here to discuss our November 2025 book club pick, Taiwan Travelogue by Yang Shuangzi, translated by Lin King. As always, Books and Boba is supported in part by our listeners. So if you've been enjoying our podcast and want to become a bigger part of our book club, you can do so by heading on over to patreon.com/booksandboba, where as an official member, you gain access to our members only Discord server. And if you join us at the Honey Boba level, you also gain access to our monthly bonus podcast, Boba Chats, where Rira and I recently had a very lively discussion about AI and Game of Thrones. Our Honey Boba members also have the opportunity to help us pick a Patron's Choice book club pick once per quarter. And our next Patron's Choice is coming up for our January pick. So if you join now, you might have a chance to help us decide what we are reading next month. But yeah, Rira, we've made it. It is the last month of 2025. How do you feel?
Oh my God. Can you believe that the LA fires were at the beginning of 2025? And we finally made it all the way to December 2025.
This year has felt like 10 years.
Like, I literally cannot believe that I started 2025 escaping a wildfire and relocating because of smoke in my apartment. And now I'm living in a new place. I mean, not because of the fires. My old place is fine. But yeah, it's just... What is it? I have like two friends who recently went to Japan. Like one of them is still there right now. And in my head, I was like, oh, I should go to Japan. But then I remembered that I went to Japan in April. And I'm like, what? That feels like
that's true.
2 years ago.
You had your whole wedding world tour this year.
Apparently, like that has tricked a lot of people into thinking that I got married this past year, and I'm like, no, I got married in 2024. I mean, at the receptions, people are like, oh, like, where's the bride? I'm like, I've been married for quite a while now. But it's also like tricked my mom because she was like, I can't believe you're not spending your first Thanksgiving with me as like a married woman. And I'm like, what are you talking about? Like the first Thanksgiving I spent with you as a married woman, which doesn't really like mean anything to me personally. I did have Thanksgiving with you. That was November 2024. I got married in October 2024. So time has just like escaped all meaning. And I just feel like this year has been just...
Yeah.
Really, just half a lifetime.
Yeah, well, you know, at least it's almost over. Now we got 2026 to look forward to. Surely things can only go up from here.
I don't know. Like, things just keep going down. I mean, if you've read Project 2025, it's not looking so good. they've completed a lot of things on their checklist. And I'm like, can we do something about that? I don't know. But we are moving on from terrors in our government today to, I guess, colonial history in a different,
yeah.
a different country.
So, before we get started on our discussion of Taiwan Travelogue, just a quick standard spoiler warning. In our book club discussions, we do discuss all aspects of our book club pick, including any plot and character spoilers. So if spoilers do matter to you, this is your cue to hit pause, finish the book, and then once you're finished, you can come back and listen to the rest of our discussion. But with that said, let's get into it. Let's start off our discussion, as always, with the book jacket description of Taiwan Travelogue.
May 1938, the young novelist Aoyama Chisuko has sailed from her home in Nagasaki, Japan, and arrived in Taiwan. She's been invited there by the Japanese government ruling the island, though she has no interest in their official banquets or imperialist agenda. Instead, Chisuko longs to experience real island life and to taste as much of its authentic cuisine as her famously monstrous appetite can bear. Soon, a Taiwanese woman, who is younger even than she is, and who shares the characters of her name, is hired as her interpreter and makes her dreams come true. The charming, erudite, meticulous Chizuru arranges Chizuko's travels all over the land of the South and also proves to be an exceptional cook. Over scenic train rides and braised pork rice, lively banter, and winter melon tea, Chizuko grows infatuated with her companion and intent on drawing her closer. But something causes Chizuru to keep her distance. It's only after a heartbreaking separation that Chizuko begins to grasp what the something is. So Taiwan Travelogue was originally published in 2020 in Mandarin. And it was translated into English in 2024, and it won the 2024 National Book Award for Translated Literature. This book is, like, topsy-turvy, I would say, with a lot of its, like, backstory and made-up history around it. So I think we should probably get that out of the way before we start discussing in depth, because there was controversy over this book when it originally published in 2020, because a lot of people thought that this was a nonfiction book. They thought that it was actually written by the novelist and the protagonist in the book, Aoyama Chizuko, because the first edition had credited her as the author and said Yang Shangji was the translator and not the author. So this created a lot of uproar on, like, the quote-unquote deception, and the second edition, which was quickly printed, corrected the first edition's mistake and said, hey, written by Yang Shangqi, which is also, like, the pen name of Yang Zhoushu, who is, I can't do the pronunciations correctly, I'm so sorry, you guys, but Yang Shangji is the pen name of Yang Zhoushu, and apparently, like, Shangji means twins in Chinese.
Shuangzi, yeah. It's twins.
Yeah, Shuangzi. Yeah. And the pen name's supposed to pay homage to Yang's twin sister, who passed away from cancer in 2015. So there's, like, layers to this, right? So the book, Taiwanese Travelogue, is disguised as a modern Mandarin translation of a Japanese novel that was originally published in 1954 based on a fictionalized account of a Japanese novelist's travels in Taiwan during 1938. So 15 years prior to what the book said, what the fictional book was published in.
Yeah. So this is my, like, overall, like, macro take on the book, which is I thought the book was way more interesting as a thought exercise with all the meta layers than as, like, a narrative itself. I thought the story of this woman coming to Taiwan and, like, eat, pray, loving through with her guide, I thought the travel part was interesting as someone whose family comes from Taiwan. But, like, as a love story, as a narrative, I thought it was, you know, straightforward, competent, but not, like, super compelling, right? It's only when you add in the additional meta layers of, like, this book as a piece of metafiction as a whole, that the story becomes way more compelling. And what I found interesting is, and what we realized when we were discussing on Discord, the audiobook version of this book actually does not have the forward or afterwards that the printed version has, which kind of create those meta layers. So if you listen to the audiobook, you're missing the entire like meta fictional like
yeah I was
story.
I was gonna mention this because I had originally started reading this book on audiobook through Libro.fm. We're not sponsored, but you guys should sign up because they're great. The audiobook is narrated by Sarah Scare. Yeah, like in the Libro.fm edition, it doesn't have the translator's prologue. It doesn't have any of the afterwards in the book. It's just simply the story, and it doesn't narrate the footnotes at all. So it wasn't until Marvin and I did our Boba chat and he mentioned like, oh, like there's like footnotes and it's like metafiction. And I was like, what? What do you mean? So I had to go buy the ebook, and lo and behold, there was like 20 pages that were not narrated at the beginning of the book. And I was like, are they allowed to do this?
Yeah.
I feel like it's very important for like the context like of the story.
It has a lengthy foreword by a fictional scholar, which they don't really mention is fictional. You don't really know unless you know, right? And I know there's some...
They don't even read it out loud in the audiobook. Yeah. It skipped directly to chapter one. And I was like, wait, what? Like, this was missing.
And then there's also like three afterwards, two of which were by additional fictional characters, the daughters of the main characters from the first book, that kind of tells you what happens afterwards, in addition to the author, the original author, Yang Shuangzi, writing her own metafictional afterword as the quote-unquote translator for the book. And it's,
yeah so like to break it down even further, like the first afterword, it says like the manuscript was rediscovered by Aoyama Chisuko's adoptive daughter, who reissued and sent the manuscript to O Chizuru, who is the interpreter, the second protagonist in this book, who was living in Texas at the time. The manuscript was then translated into its first Mandarin edition by O Chizuru's daughter. And finally, the official author of the book, Yang Chengshu, claims to be the translator of the new Mandarin edition because they rediscovered the manuscript through like archival.
Well, her and her sister were on a trip to Japan and were excited to see mention of a Taiwan travel log, and so went to go look it up and found that it was out of print. And you know, it's a very like, it reminded me of the whole saga with, you remember the whole saga with Nono Boy and how like that went out of print and then someone tried to publish it and stuff. It kind of reminded me of that. It was like, it's like the original text was like self-published or published independently and it was lost to time. But then it was found again and redistributed in like a more, you know, modern context. And I mean, I definitely
found... And it's funny because they mentioned like in the modern context, they're like, oh, because we don't have like the original manuscript, like from the actual like Japanese manuscript. There are a lot of things that were taken out in the final edition because of Taiwan censorship laws.
Yeah.
So keep that in mind,
so,
readers.
Yeah.
And I was like, what? Like,
so
this is all fake, though.
What's so interesting about the meta layers is it also exists in history. And the fact that the first version translated to Chinese had to be censored because it was published in 1990, when Taiwan was still coming out of martial law from the KMT. And the version we're reading is the re-release of the original manuscript, uncensored, in like, was it 2010 or something? Like, it was way more recent.
It is like an Inception Russian doll-esque scheme of just like translations. And it's like really funny because if you're reading the English edition, like we did, there's like an actual translator note from Lin King, who is the English translator of this book. And it's just like so funny how like she is an actual character in the book with Yang, who is like a fictional translator along with like other translators. It's so fascinating.
But the thing that I found most fascinating is her actual... I made a mistake. There are actually three or four afterwards. One from each daughter, One from Ochizuru/Wang, I think Wang Qingho is her actual name, Chinese name. And then one by Lin King. And Lin King's like kind of translator's note at the end is the only one that's not metafiction. She's actually talking about the exercise of translating this book. And after reading the book and after reading her notes, like, I get why this book won Best Translation for the National Book Awards last year, because like there's a lot of translating going on, especially with the shared characters between Chinese and Japanese. And so I think like just the feat of translating this text, which is in itself a very twisty, like nuance plays a lot into like pulling this off. I think Lin did a really good job translating everything.
Yeah, so like Lin did an interview with Electric Lit, and it's a really fascinating interview. I recommend people to go read it. I'll try to have like the link on our socials. But King wrote, because there was already a translator in the story, the structure allowed me to interject myself as a translator in the text in a way that's not normally done in English language translations, where there tends to be an emphasis on seamlessness that makes readers forget that they're reading a translation at all. And I'm like paraphrasing here. And she says that this allowed her to have more room for translation, like, which is hilarious. And it is like really funny that like she had to consult with the Japanese translator of Taiwanese Travelogue, which was translated like a year before Lin got brought onto the project. So like Japan published Taiwanese Travelogue, and that was translated by Yuko Miura. And she also won like a major Japanese translation award, because what a metafiction of a book. Like, how do you even begin to translate a Taiwanese so-called translation of a fictional Japanese
guy playing another guy, right? It's like,
yeah, yeah, yeah. So like Lin was saying, like, how like she would have to fact check with Yoko Miura's Japanese translation, because she's like, oh, is this how like Japanese people colonialized the like Taiwanese terms? They were like, well, like she wanted to get it correct in terms of like how Japanese people pronounce certain Taiwanese words. Yeah. It's just like, how do I romanize that? How do I keep accents in? It is like a mind like fuckery of a job that she had to do.
Right, because the Japanese translation would actually be closer to the fictional original text of the book than the actual original text, right?
Yeah. And Yang Shuangzhu, the author, in an interview with Straight Times, she wrote, I wanted people to treat it as a history and then find contradictions and fictitious elements in it to introduce doubt. We tend to believe history as truth, but we don't remember that someone is always writing that history. I want readers to be suspicious of history. And I thought this was really interesting, because she is talking about her book, right? It's like, hey, like it's a novel, but people thought it was real because of like the way it was presented. But also it kind of just reminded me of like how textbooks were censored in not just like Taiwan, but also like in Japan and like mainland China. Like, it's just like, oh yeah, like history got distorted by the people who were churning out those history books. So
I mean, even as we learned from the afterwards, like the story that we read is also a biased point of view.
Yeah. So I just think it's really funny that people were really angry that they were deceived. They're like, oh, I thought this was nonfiction, but it's like, it's fiction. And like, that's like not right. And I'm like, well, it still tells you the truth, right? Like,
yeah.
Fiction was used to distort the truth, but also to reveal it. So it is interesting in how like fiction is used as like a device to tell history and tell like who, like tell how like the narrative gaze changes depending on if it's being told by a colonizer or the colonized.
Yeah. And I think, you know, for me, reading this book was really interesting because, like, you know, my family is, well, okay, my parents were born and raised in Taiwan, but my grandparents were, and I wasn't. But my family, like, if we were to say, if I was to tell you, like, what I identify as, like, I think I identify more as a Taiwanese Chinese than, like, a mainlander, right? Even though, like, I've probably been to more mainland places than in Taiwan. And that's, you know, that's a whole other thing. That's, you know, when you're growing up, going to, you know, grandma's, going to Taiwan to visit grandma during the summer, they don't really let you go and explore a lot. They're very paranoid about you getting kidnapped because you're, you know, from America and don't know how things work, even though Taipei is one of, like, the safest cities in Asia. But it was interesting to kind of explore a Taiwan that even my family has no history with, right? This was a Taiwan before my family, because my family came to Taiwan in the period between the end of World War II and the end of the Civil War.
When I was listening to this on audiobook, like, my husband, Dan, was, like, sitting next to me at the time, and he was like, okay, I'm going to ask a very ignorant question, but, like, don't think that I'm, like, stupid. I'm just, you know, I'm just, like, uninformed. And I was like, yeah, sure, go. And he's like, why are they addressing each other as, like, san and sensei when they're in Taiwan? Like, why are they talking in Japanese? And I was like, oh, that's because Taiwan was Japan's colony for 50 years. And he was like, wait, what, 50 years? And I was like, yeah, half a century. It was like, it's like 20 years longer than Korea was colonized. So
yeah,
he was just like, huh, okay, I did not know that. And I was like, yeah, it's amazing how, like, a lot of Americans don't know that history.
It is interesting to read this alongside, like, a book like Pachinko, right, where you kind of also see the different sides of what life was like under Japanese colonial rule.
Yeah, like, I think it's a really good point, like, bringing up, like, Pachinko and, like, how that's also a book about a diaspora that we don't really hear much about in American, in Asian American literature. And I do like how there's, like, specificity in, like, the levels of the tiers of diaspora in Taiwan. Like, Chizuru goes through them being like, well, they're the people who came from, like, mainland China, but that was, like, hundreds of years ago. So, like, they're not, like, native to the island, but also they've been here for quite a long time. So, like, do we call them natives? It's so I just thought it was, like, really interesting that, like, for the Taiwanese people in this book, like, they always have to, like, figure out what they are to themselves and also to other people, because it's like, oh, like, you have the character Mishima, who is Japanese descent, but he was born and raised in Taiwan. But it's like, does he see himself as an islander, as a Taiwanese person? I mean, I'm sure he does, like, personally, but then, like, the rest of society doesn't, because they're like, oh, you're, like, part of the Yamato race. Like,
yeah, it becomes, like, super muddled. I mean, we see this with, like, people in Hawaii, right? Like, you have the indigenous Hawaiians, but you also have the Japanese, Korean, and, you know, white people that have been there for generations now, and there's still, like, that conflict there. Who gets to be a local?
Yeah. And honestly, I don't think it's any of our business as, like, outsiders to, like, determine, like, what they identify as, you know?
Yeah. And so we had a pretty lengthy discussion in Discord about the foreword, right? The first foreword leading into the book. And the interesting way it sets up the book, it sets up the text as, like, a, you know, quote-unquote real piece that was written after the war about colonial Taiwan. And then the scholar ask the readers to read the book, keeping in mind the colonial nature of the relationship between Chizuru and Chizuko. And we had a discussion on whether or not that was actually, like, necessary, right? Like, whether or not we needed that in order to read the book. And part of that is, like, some of our Patreon members thought it kind of gave too much away about what the book was going to be about. On the other hand, like, I kind of felt like, okay, like, for me, as someone who reads a lot of, you know, we've read a lot of post-colonial literature for this podcast, a lot of Asian American literature, a lot of Asian diaspora literature is all about those, like, post-colonial things. What happens after colonization? What are the effects of colonization on people? And so, you know, I think as a minority, like, as a member of the diaspora, a minority diaspora in the country, that's just my state of mind. I approach a lot of fiction with that post-colonial lens and reading into like the power dynamics between like oppressor and oppressed, right? But I wonder if that's not the case for readers of other communities, right? Because like I mentioned, this book was originally published in Taiwan. Taiwan hasn't been a colonial state. Well, that's not true. It's complicated, right? Because Taiwan has always been a colonial state. But, you know, I wonder if the people reading the book straight up, like the people who got upset that this wasn't an actual like historical text, aren't primed to think that way, right? Aren't primed to think about the relationship between Chizuru and Chizuko as colonizer and colonizer.
Well, I think also, like, I think it is funny that in Taiwan, like, yeah, sure, Mandarin is one of the main languages, but you also have Taiwanese, which is like very different. So in a sense, Mandarin is a colonial language just as much as English is a colonial language. So I think having that disclaimer to readers who are reading it in a colonial language saying, hey, think about the relationship between the colonizer and the colonized, like think about the power dynamics as you are reading about these two women and their friendship. And it's like, yeah, it can come across as very obvious to people like us who are like a minority. If you're part of the dominant culture, you're always going to assume that there's someone to translate for you, you know? And like, I feel like for a lot of us who are part of a marginalized group, we are the Chizurus. Like, we constantly are in that role of like, okay, we have to
fit ourselves to your expectations.
Yeah, fit right? ourselves to your expectations to a narrative that could be like skewed. Like we always have to like have we always have to like pay attention extra to like the power dynamics in our lives. So it's just very natural to us. But of course, if you're like part of the dominant group and you probably don't know much about history, then yeah, I think that disclaimer is very much needed, because otherwise you're going to read this book being like, what a nice eat, pray, love story about women and friendship and allyship.
Yeah,
and
blah, blah, blah. Why is like, Chi-Chan so cold to this really nice girl that just wants to be her friend? Like, why is she so resistant? Why doesn't she want a better life?
I did think it was interesting how, like, I think this is where Lin King's, like, award for translation is like very much merited, because in Japanese and also in Mandarin, like there is like a very formal type of speech that you reserve for, you know, your superiors. And in English, we don't really have that. So she had to like write the relationship in a way where it wasn't as obvious, because the language has changed, right? So it's like, when you're reading it in Mandarin, it's like, okay, yeah, like it's very obvious that Chizuru is drawing a boundary here by refusing to drop the honorifics, by refusing to talk casually. But in English, it's like, oh, why is it so bad for her to, you know, consider her as a friend? Because that like demarcation is kind of gone in the English translation.
Yeah, I feel like that kind of like polite speech in English kind of comes off as sarcastic most of the time, right? It's like it's
I
more
think
like...
I think it is like really funny, because like a lot of American tourists, for example, they'll go to like Korea or Japan and they'll say, oh, they're so nice, they're so polite. And I'm like, you are mistaking their politeness for niceness.
Yeah.
Their politeness for generosity. It is not the same thing, I assure you.
Like, yeah, yeah. And something that like you key in on as people descended from places that were colonized by, let's say, Japan, is maybe there's a reason why our service cultures are all like this. And it's like, you know, the remnants of like being forced to, you know,
accommodate.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. Yeah. And it's, and you see, like, how Aoyama, like, she increasingly gets frustrated by how, like, Chizuru is, you know, creating this boundary and not dropping honorifics and, you know, not, like, kind of, like, showing displeasure, but not really. Like, she's always describing Chizuru to have, like, a no face mask, a stage mask. She never really knows what Chizuru is actually thinking. And whereas, like, Aoyama is like, oh, I'm like an open book. And I'm like, yeah, because you are the colonizer. You're allowed to be an open book.
Yeah.
No, like, if people get offended by you, they can't do anything because the punishment, like, retaliation exists, okay, for the people who are colonized. So it's like, if you're being extremely obtuse and rude, like, how can someone who is, like, your employee and also, like, the colonized respond to that other than politeness and just, you know, being like, I'm not so sure about that. Like, diverting the attention.
It's such a classic, like, I feel like it's a trope in some sort of foreign fiction, but it's like the rich, you know, business person, the rich, like, elite, like, aristocrat whose only friend is, like, their assistant, but he's only their friend because he's employed.
Yeah, like, this kind of reminds me of what is it? There was, like, an exhibition, like, semi-recently called, like, Hidden in Plain Sight, and it was a series of photographs with, like, the children of white slave owners and their companion slave. And it's like the slave girl is dressed in fine dresses, but, like, not as fine as, like, the daughter of the slave owners. And, you know, like, in these, like, diary entries of, like, the slave owner's daughter, they'll be like, oh, yeah, like, my companion, she's my best friend. And, like, I share, like, all of my deepest, darkest secrets with them. And, you know, I give them, like, trinkets to, like, beautify, like, their, to accessorize their dresses. And it's like, you think that you are friends with a slave. That is a little bit delusional. But also, like, that's kind of what the relationship is here with Aoyama and Chizuru, although not as extreme as, like, yeah, slave owner and slave. But
but then, like, it's like, you know, I think you and I read this and, like, oh, yeah, Chizuru is just being a professional. You know, every time that Aoyama diverges from the schedule, makes them late for things, like, I just know in the background she is getting, like, Chizuru is getting in trouble for everything that she does, right? And, you know, Mishima,
yeah, and you
pretty
find
much
out
says that.
Yeah, she does. Yeah. I was also just thinking, like, I mean, people mentioned this too. They're like, wow, for an interpreter, you're, like, going, like, above and beyond, you know, you're, like, cooking for her, you're peeling, like, seeds for her, you're, like, it's very much like a personal assistant job. Like, the boundaries of the role has, like, kind of been muddled.
There's scope creep for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's just like, oh man, if someone did that, and people do that today with their employees, you know, like,
yeah,
bosses will be like, hey, like, why don't we, like, go and have our kwaesik, which is, like, Korean, like,
Yeah, I mean, isn't that just Korean corporate culture you're talking about right now? It's like, you're supposed to be your boss's best friend because you're expected to. Because
they don't want to go home or they're lonely. Yeah. And it's just like, oh my gosh, like, let me clock out.
And, you know, that comes into, like, direct focus at the end in, you know, Chizuru or Wang Qingho's own afterword, where she recounts, like, what working with Aoyama-san was actually like, which is, she was kind of a demand. She was kind of like a toddler, like, just demanding all these things.
Oh, she was 100% a toddler. Like, even reading from Aoyama's perspective, I'm just like, I'm like, poor lady, like, poor Chizuru. Like, why are you putting, like, she's like, isn't Chizuru so great? She's able to cook everything. She's so sophisticated. Everything is, like, so much easier with her. She needs to come to Nagasaki with me. I need to free her from her oppressive marriage. And it's like,
yeah,
I think she needs to be freed from you, the demanding boss that's making her do things after hours. Like, the afterword that you're talking about, Marvin, like, it talks about how like, there was an episode where Aoyama wanted to eat, like, noodles
because she was sick.
Yeah, and she wanted, like, a specific noodle dish. And Chizuru made literally, like, 6 different noodle dishes. And she was like, surely this will be enough. Like, she will be full after, like, these six dishes.
Right, because Ayama-san kept requesting changes and updates. Like, you know, I want one with this now. Now I want one with this broth. And
well, it's just, like, first she's like, oh, like, for the next bowl I eat, I hope I can have this topping with these vegetables or whatever. And even though she doesn't phrase it as, like, oh, make me that right now, there's that undercurrent of, like, hey, I expect this, so go fetch it. And Chizuru is just like, I'm so tired, and I, like, don't want to make another fucking bowl of noodles. But now she's asking for iced chilled noodles because she's too hot from eating all the hot noodle bowls. So she's like, ah. Like,
yeah, but from her perspective, oh, Chi-chan's so great. She just knows exactly what I want. It's like, no. You don't understand the power dynamics here.
You're abusing your power and you don't even know it. Ah.
Yeah.
And there are times when Aoyama will say things that are really, you know, like microaggressive and doesn't understand like how like biased her point is. And like one of the things that she says is like, it's like, oh, the Empire's coercive methods are unpleasant, but the beautiful Sakura are innocent of any crime. And it's like, just because something is pretty, just because something, the end result is nice, doesn't mean we should just ignore all the ugliness that made the result. It's just...
And she does it all the time. It's like very like, you know, we have language for it now. It's performative, right? Because she outwardly says, I don't want to support the Empire Southern campaign. I'm not one of those Japanese, but I do like the Japanese changes that have been brought to your island. Isn't it great that you guys have trains now that run efficiently?
Isn't it great that like all your old temples got rebuilt? And it's like, but why were they rebuilt? And also, did they rebuild it accurately? They like added their own like culture to it, and it's been Japanified. Yeah.
And even you know, that one chapter where after Chien-ho quits and Mishima becomes her translator slash assistant again, he even says, yeah, like, who even knows if Taiwanese culture will survive after that? Like, you know, him as someone who is Japanese, but also because he grew up, because he was raised in the islands, also holds affinity to it, is also seeing, like, the culture that he loves is also disappearing.
Yeah, there's also, like, there's a scene where Aoyama is telling Chizuru, like, oh, you know, I stayed in Okinawa and Hokkaido, and those are places with indigenous populations and their culture is being erased. And a reason why I love traveling to places like these is to like create like an accurate account of it before the culture disappears. Very like anthropologist like point of view. And Chizuru quietly says, but things are already changing here. Like,
yeah, what's unsaid is like, it's my culture that is disappearing, like,
which is why like it's so important when this is why we say own voices is important, although own voices has now kind of been, you know, distorted and it's not really used in publishing anymore as a positive thing. But it's like, you need to center the voice of the people who own that culture, you know, rather than being like, oh, I was like, oh, I want to save this culture. So I'm going to like come in with my outsider view and explain it to everybody else, when it's like, you don't have the authority to do that. Like,
yeah. And, you know, I feel like the way Aoyama travels is the way that I typically like travel, which is like, I like to, you know, participate in, or I like to explore, you know, like local scenes and stuff. But I think she also has a very like inflated ego about it, right? Like, she is thinking, oh, I'm traveling the way people should travel. I don't want to live, like, I'm not a resort person. I don't need banquets. Like, I want street food. I want to experience culture. But she's still bringing with her like a very like colonial mindset, right? And I think that's what always, like, bringing this book with that like post-colonial frame of mind, like, you can see it. Like, every, like, a lot of interactions between Chizuru and Chizuko are like uncomfortable like that, right? Because we can read it, because we're, I guess, equipped with the lens to see the power dynamics in play.
Yeah, and like Aoyama, like she is like she says like she is not like those other Japanese. She doesn't want to write for the Japanese like empire's propaganda, but she still writes for the empire. She's writing these travel essays that are being published in Japanese mainland newspapers. So I'm like, in a sense, you are still complicit in the empire's agenda, just because you're not like doing, you're not following their orders exactly, doesn't mean that your art isn't being used as a political tool. Because art is always going to be political, as well as food. Food will always be political. I mean, we see how Taiwanese cuisine has kind of adapted with each wave of colonizers, you know? Like, even with the Dutch, like, I think they, like, planted a different kind of rice. Like it was briefly mentioned in the book how there's, like, the mainland Chinese rice, and then they have, like, the rice that, like, existed indigenously, and then you have, like, the short grain rice that the Japanese planted, and it's, like...
Yeah.
Yeah, that's political because it's showing the history of like who is being conquered and what the cultural cost is for quote unquote improvement or invention.
And even like the, you know, the authentic Taiwanese cuisine she seeks out, which is a lot of Hakka cuisine, that in itself is also brought over from the mainland. And it was kind of interesting, Reed, because you know, these days when we say the mainland in Taiwan, we mean China. But China, back then, the mainland was Japan, which... Kurokuma is also a bunch of islands, so it's interesting that that's the mainland. But as frustrating as Chizuko was in her relationship with Chizuru, she was a really good travel writer. I can see why she was commissioned to come and write travel logs by the Japanese government, because the travel log part of the book I thought was really well done. I really enjoyed their exploration of the Taiwanese countryside, of Taiwanese food, and they did feature a lot of foods that like I recognized, I grew up with. More specifically, the lubabong, which was the minced meat rice, which growing up, that's what my mom called minced meat rice. You know, the Mandarin word is lu lo fan, but we would call it lubabong. And to be honest, the version that we made is closer to the basopong, the lo zao fan, which is more using ground pork than minced pork belly. And just like the book mentioned that every family has their own recipe, you know, my family's recipe calls for ground pork belly, so it kind of actually combines like the aspects of both baso and lubabong. But I really like those parts of the book. And so what did you think of the travelogue portions of the book?
Maybe it's because I've watched a lot of like Anthony Bourdain like episodes on like when he travels and he tries food, and like I see him as like the ideal traveler, you know, someone who is like interacting with the locals, kind of like looks into like the political climate of the place that he is visiting. And I'm like, Aoyama is not Anthony Bourdain.
No, she's not. Yeah.
No, she's not. And with like there's it's not even so much that like she is like racist, but she's also like very classist, you know, like Chizuru, like, you know, she admits that, you know, she grew up on jute soup, and jute is like a material that like the Japanese use for like fibers, and it's just like assumed that if you make jute soup, you're poor, and that's like all your diet allows. And Aoyama's like, oh, like why don't you make that for me? It's like part of your childhood, right? And it's like, yeah, part of her painful childhood. Like, why are you making her make this food for you? And she says, like, it might be called poor people's food, but the number of steps it takes to make muantin, which is the jute soup, is no less involved than a banquet dish. And I'm like, you're romanticizing poor people soup, and it's like so demeaning. She does this again at the train station, where like she's like, oh, like I really want like the, what is it, the dagashi? Like there's like a difference between casual like street food and then like the more like formal version of it that you get at like restaurants. And she's like, no, like I want to have the authentic experience. And it's like, who is able to afford the authentic experience. Like,
yeah,
it's
very, and you know, it's funny because like we see these dynamics play out even present day, right? There's a lot of parallels of like, you know, the way that Ayama travels and the way that, you know, modern rich people travel, and modern rich people kind of co-opt poor people food and turn it into like fine dining.
Yeah, like the, like in Parasite, the chapaguri, like the black bean noodles with like pork in it or steak in it or whatever. Like I've seen restaurants add that to their menus and actually like charge people like extra for it. And I'm like, it's literally instant ramen, like instant noodles. Like this is literally what poor people came up with because they were hungry and they needed like something more substantial than what the package provided. So
yeah,
it is very much that.
I did like how the book did try to like add context, like historical context to a lot of things, right? I feel like, you know, Chizuru was like fighting for her life trying to explain to Ayama like the colonial histories and like the context of the Taiwan that they're exploring. Ayama was just too brutish, right? Too oblivious to note, right? Because she has her idealized idea of what Taiwan is, and is a Taiwan that's been quote-unquote improved by Japanese occupation.
Yeah, by Japanese technology and stuff. And I do, like, what I do like about this book is, like, the colonized are, like, extremely brutally, like, victimized, like, graphically in the text. It's like, oh, colonialism can look like this. It can look like a lot of nice technological advancements and like good food fusion food, but there is like this undercurrent of like maliciousness, you know? So it's just like there's like nice racism, and that's kind of like how I felt when Aoyama would like praise Taiwanese things, and I'm like, oh, it's coming with like a stroke of superiority complex.
Well, because correct me if I'm wrong, but Taiwan was like the Japan's like model colony, right? It wasn't the colony used for hard labor like say Korea was, but it was like this island colony is how we're going to show off how Japanese culture makes things better.
Propaganda.
Yeah, it feels almost American reading it as like an Asian American.
Well, that's the thing, like you know, like with the disclaimer in the book, be like, hey, think about like the relationship between the colonized and the colonizer when you're reading this. And I was like, yeah, because you're reading this in a colonizer language, you are probably the Aoyama. Like in most situations, if you are part of the dominant culture, and even as like Asian Americans, it's like, yeah, we do reap privileges that, you know, the locals don't have. So it's just like, yeah, you have to be conscious of it, which I think makes for good travel, you know? Like, I know people want like authenticity when it comes to like traveling and eating good food, but it's like also you have to be conscious of like how that authenticity has been compromised by colonial powers and how you are complicit in the system that you are, you know, rejecting. It's like you just kind of have to be aware of all these things when you travel. And you know, it's not saying, like, I'm not saying that, like, you shouldn't travel because, like, you're part of the dominant culture. I'm just saying that, like, to be a responsible traveler, I feel like you need to know the history and respect it and also center the locals' perspective over yours, which is something that Aoyama did not do in this book. She's constantly imposing her views on the culture onto Chizuru, who, you know, kind of rebels by like correcting her gently. And and you know, like colonialism is bad. And like I said, like I like how this book shows like what nice racism can be. It is still insidious, but it is like, oh, it can look like this.
It can look like a friendship you can't refuse, right? It's like they're being nice to you. They want to
benefits.
Yeah, they want to save you. If you go with them, you'll be taken care of, but you'll still be subordinate your entire life, right? It's like, it's not exactly freedom. It's just protection under the system. And that's different than emancipation.
And it's brought up when like Chizuru is like, yeah, but have you thought about if I wanted this protection? And it's like, yeah, did you ask? And the thing is, like, there, if people did not understand that Aoyama was being brutish with her cultural projections and her biased view, I think it really comes to a head when Aoyama's like, hey, my one wish is for Chi-chan to wear a kimono.
Yeah. And
I was just like, oh my God. Like, if he didn't get the message before, now you have, because that's like, what are you doing? That's...
That was so...
And also, like, Chi-chan was like, I don't want to do it. And then she was like, but why don't you want to do it? And then
you
like,
look
well,
so
I don't
great
do
in
it.
Yeah, it's... So this book, this was also brought up in our Discord discussion, which is this book was marketed as a bittersweet love story, but we didn't read a love story. We read kind of like a...
It's a one-sided like, infatuation. I will say, like, I don't think the interpersonal parts were, like, fake. I feel like Chizuru did have, like, fondness for Aoyama. Like, I do think that she... thought Aoyama had good intentions and a good heart. However, that does not negate the colonial mindset that Aoyama presented, and just like the power dynamics just make it really weird.
Yeah, if this really was a romance, this would be a story about how they overcame their class differences and found common ground. But I think the book does a really takes a more realistic route, which is like there is no common ground between oppressed and oppressed, and a relationship built on a master subordinate position is like, it's not a real friendship, right? Like, friendship only exists if both sides see it as a friendship. And like, we see again and again that only one side actually sees it as a friendship, the other side sees it as obligation.
And I do like how that's like shown through food, because in the beginning Chizuru like doesn't eat with Aoyama because like subordinate should not be eating sharing a meal with their superior, and like they kind of compromise by like, okay, well, can you like drink something? And then it like moves on to like snacks, like they're able to like peel things off for each other. And then you know, like Aoyama was like, hey, like I want you to live with me, like she was very insistent on it. And then Chizuru was just like, I don't want that, but thank you for the offer. And then it like, and then she like brings, when she does finally stay with Aoyama, like Chizuru mentions like, oh, I didn't want you to like put me in the servants' quarter, because that's just a humiliation that I don't want to go through. But also like, you know, if you hadn't offered me the servants' quarters and like, you know, let me like sleep in the same room with you, that also feels like obligation that like I should feel grateful for, and she doesn't really want to feel that. Like, this is not a love story. This is hey, my boss is infatuated with me, and we have a toxic codependent relationship, and I don't know. Like, I don't really see it as a love story. I see the queer undertones of it for sure. I do see the friendship. I do see like the womanly bond, you know, like women at this time, they were also under, you know, a lot of restrictions because of patriarchy and all that shit. So I'm like,
yeah, what surprised me about,
yeah.
Yeah. What surprised me about the book was how overt everything was, right? I wasn't expecting more of like a subtle take on colonialism during this time, but like everything was kind of in your face. Like, hey, this is someone exerting their power over someone who can't fight back.
It might be really obvious to us, but it does make me wonder if it's not that obvious to people who are, you know, part of the dominant culture.
Yeah, so I guess to wrap up our discussion of Taiwan Travelogue, I think overall, like I mentioned at the top, I did enjoy the book, but I think the story itself, like novel itself, is kind of, it's very straightforward, right? It follows like a very standard rom-com pacing, right? You start off, two opposites are attracted to each other, and then something happens in the third act to break them up, and then there's a reconciliation. And I think what I appreciate about the book is it didn't go for like the happy ending. This isn't a book about two people overcoming their differences, overcoming their class struggles to like find true love, because the gap between Chizuru and Chizuko are just, it's too big to overcome. And was interesting the fact that, like, you know, the forward sets up that the 12th chapter of this novel where Chizuko seeks out Chizuru and, you know, kind of lays everything on the table and reconciles with her, didn't actually exist in the original publication in context of like the metafiction, right? Didn't exist in the original publication. It was only added in subsequent editions to like round out the story to give closure for readers.
Yeah. And this is probably the primary reason why it's called a novel and not like an actual travelogue, because that was completely made up, like it does not exist. There's a quote that Yang says as a translator, as a fictitious translator. She says, "A novel is a piece of amber, one that coagulates both the real past and the made-up ideals. It is something that can be visited again and again in its unparalleled beauty." And it's like, yeah, this may be fake. This entire thing may be fake, not just like this reconciliation, but also like, you know, Aoyama's existence and like the existence of like multiple manuscripts. But it is telling the truth. It is very much something that people can, it is like a time capsule that people can visit and be like, okay, this is kind of what colonized Taiwan was like under Japanese rule. And this is kind of what kind of relationships people may have had with people who are like Japanese mainlanders and whatnot.
Because we do see like a few other examples of this dynamic throughout the book as well. Like we have the two students from the girls' school. We have like the two boys that Aoyama passes by at the market. And we also have the relationship of Mishima with Taiwan as well. So a lot of examples showing like this relationship, while what we're focused on isn't unique in this time. And to be honest, like it is a timeless story because this relationship between colonizer and colonized, it's not exclusive to Japan and Taiwan. It's also, it happens all over the place, wherever there is an oppressor community and the oppressed community living together.
Yeah. I guess like a final note for me is like, I mean, it's very random, but Aoyama and Chichan's relationship kind of reminded me of like classic Yuri relationships that you see in like animes and mangas.
Like rich girl, poor girl type of like...
Rich girl, poor girl, or like charismatic protector over like the super feminine, elegant like counterpart. Like I think of like Sailor, you know, Sailor Moon, like Sailor Neptune and Sailor Uranus. Cardcaptor Sakura, yeah, like a lot of relationships where it's like, yeah, it's a girl romance, but the vibes are a little bit off because of power dynamics.
Yeah, someone on our Discord asked, like, how do you think this book was received, or how do you think this got published back in like the 1950s? And like my answer to them was like, you know, I'm sure at the time of publication, people just thought they were just really, really good friends. Right?
Oh yeah, yeah. Just like in real history where they're like, oh, this person who was living with another like woman who was like unmarried. Yeah, they were totally friends. They were besties. They were roommates. Nothing romantic about them at all, even though they spent their whole lives together living in one house.
Yeah, it did make me sad that they didn't get a chance to see each other again afterwards. But I did like that in the end, they were able to kind of mend the relationship through this book, right? Through the act of Aoyama writing the book and eventually getting it into the hands of Chien-ho Chi-chan, who personally did the translation, even though she was very old at the time. And it was like the last thing she ever did, right?
Yeah. I think it's a very like fascinating exercise on translation and also just exploring colonial gazes. And I think it's very playful, and I am really disappointed that the audiobook did not include all of that framing.
What a strange choice, right? Like, without the forwards and afterwards, it's literally a different book. It's a different story, right?
I mean, some of my favorite parts was just looking at the footnotes and being like, oh, okay. Like, yeah. Here are the made up footnotes and here are the real footnotes from Lynn. Like, like it, this is the type of metafiction that I can vibe with. I feel like Interior Chinatown kind of like went a little bit too far for me. So I think this was like the perfect amount of metafiction.
Yeah, it kind of reminded me of like a found footage mockumentary. And, you know, I liked the way that was executed for the page. Yeah, well, with that, that'll do it for our discussion of Taiwan Travelogue by Yang Shuangzi, translated by Lin King. If you have any thoughts on our discussion or on the book itself, please let us know on our Goodreads forums or on Discord. We always love to hear your feedback on our discussion episodes whenever possible. So before we go, Rework, can you please let us know what book we are reading to close out 2025 for our December Book Club pick?
So our final book of 2025 is Blackmail and Bibinka by Mia P. Manansala. This is the third book in the Tita Rosie's Kitchen Mystery series, and it takes place during Christmas, so I thought it was a fitting book.
Yeah, I haven't read one of Mia's books since we read her first book, Arsenic and Adobo, for author chat like way back when. So excited to jump back into the world of
Shady Palms.
Yeah. And definitely excited to dive into this Christmas-themed cozy murder mystery. It's been a while since I've read a cozy murder mystery. So, always great to jump back into the genres that we love. With that'll do it for this episode of Books and Boba. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you all next time. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Books and Boba. This podcast was hosted by Marvin Yue and Rira Yu, and edited and produced by Marvin Yue. Follow the book club on Twitter and Instagram by going to @booksandboba and engage with us on Goodreads on our Goodreads group. You can also check out past episodes of the podcast by going to booksandboba.com and by subscribing to us on your favorite podcast app. Don't forget, you can support Books and Boba and Asian American authors by purchasing books at our bookshop.org account. Check out the link in our show notes and also at booksandboba.com. Books and Boba is a proud member of the Potluck Podcast Collective, a collective of Asian American hosted podcasts featuring unique voices and stories from the Asian diaspora. Learn more about the collective and check out our fellow Potluck shows by visiting the website podcastpotluck.com. Thanks for listening.
Hungry for spicy food and even hotter conversations? Craving community and authentic storytelling? Then join the table. This is Minor Legends, a new comedy fiction podcast supported by Potluck. Pull up every week with me, Angela Wong Carbone, and follow the stories of me and my friends as we serve up tasty tales of what it means to be Asian American at our weekly dinner hang. If you enjoy deep dishing on absurd stereotypes like tiger moms who tutor your dating game rather than grades, the insanity of your parents' immigration story, to the legend of that one good Asian cousin you can never live up to, then pull up a seat and grab a plate. Featuring dinner guests like Ronnie Chang, Brian Park, Usama Siddiqui, Celia Au, Perry Young, Supriya Ganesh, and more. It's a tasty rotation that'll leave you belly laughing and steeped in relatable and spicy conversations. Can you take the heat? Listen now for free wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, sports fans. Welcome to Asians in Hockey. You may not realize it, but there's a rich history of Asians and AAPI folks who have contributed to the legacy of the greatest game on ice. From classic legends like Julie Chu and Robin Bawa, to current greats like Lia Lum and Nick Suzuki, and even rising stars like Akane Shiga and Jason Robertson. We'll cover their stories, celebrate their accomplishments, and learn about their impact on the sport of hockey. I'm Nate Nakao, former Beer League player, occasional youth hockey coach, and longtime hockey fan, and I'll be your host as we take a look at the rise of Asians in hockey. Subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Pocket Casts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Part of the Potluck Podcast Collective.